Yo, what is up, my friends? Welcome back to the What If Project podcast. My name is Glenn, and this is episode 297 of the show. And today we're talking to repeat guest Keith Giles. Keith is back on the show to talk to us about his book, The Quantum Sayings of Jesus, Decoding the Lost Gospel of Thomas. The first time I read the book of Thomas, the Gospel of Thomas, I thought to myself, this is really weird. Because like half of these sayings, there's 114 sayings of Jesus. And like half of them I kind of knew because they're in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. The other half, I'm like, I don't know what the heck, what is this? Who said this stuff? Who wrote this? What is going on with these sayings? Most of them make no sense. You got to really think about them. And even if you really think about them, you have like a headache because they just don't make any sense. I don't know what is going on here. Because usually when you read a gospel, even if it's like the Gospel of Mary or the Gospel of Judas or something like that, like these other gospels that didn't make it into the Bible, they have a story, right? There's like a story that you can try to maybe follow. But in this particular gospel, it's just these random sayings of Jesus. There is no story. There is no like really thread of thought. They all just are just, it feels like it's all over the place. But in this book, Keith brings all of those sayings that feel like they're all over the place together. Because he looks at those sayings through a very particular, important lens, which I think has the potential to change our perspective, not just on the Gospel of Thomas, but even how we read the Bible, how we think about Jesus, how we think about the world, how we think about our families, our friends, the people in line at the grocery store, the guy that flipped you off on the way to work. This book has the potential to change how we view everything and everyone. It is a really good book. The foreword was written by David Brackey. David's been on the show before to talk to us about his book, The Gnostics, also his commentary on the Gospel of Judas. And so if David Brackey is writing the foreword to a book, you know that it's really, really good. Okay, you gotta go get this book. Here's what I would do if I were you. There's 114 sayings in the Gospel of Thomas. In the book, Keith writes like a little commentary on each one. Read one saying a day over the course of the summer. Let this be like your meditation for the summer and see what your thinking is like when you come to the end of saying 114 at the end of the summer. I guarantee you, if you read this book, you let these thoughts wash over your brain and your heart, I guarantee you that things will look very differently for you down the road. Guarantee it. The book is so good, I can't talk about it enough. The links are in the show notes. Also in the show notes, links to my books, Rethinking Everything, Emerging from the Rubble, the What If Project Art Studio. I've been doing a lot of art lately. It brings me a lot of joy. If you want to go and feel my joy and hopefully recapture some of your own joy, head over to whatifproject.net/art and check out some of the very bright and colorful things I have been creating. So anyway, all that to say, my friends, links in the show notes. This is episode 297. With the great Keith Giles. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Today we have a repeat guest joining us, the one and the only Keith Giles. He has written a brand new book called The Quantum Sayings of Jesus, Decoding the Lost Gospel of Thomas. So Keith, welcome back. Say hi to the people.
Hello, peoples.
So good to have you back.
Oh, it's so great to be back. Thanks, Glenn. Thanks for doing this. Excited to talk about this book.
Definitely. So I'm excited about this book for multiple reasons. So number one, I love the Gospel of Thomas. Before we hit record, I was showing you some of my Gospel of Thomas collection, which now you have a spot on the Gospel of Thomas shelf. So congratulations. You've made it.
I'm honored to join the list.
Number two, I love talking about the discovery of the Gospel of Thomas, along with the other Nag Hammadi scripture. I think it's like a fascinating story. There's so many different angles, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment, but I also love all the wonder that like this gospel evokes, especially regarding like the maybe the diversity of early Christianity that many of us were taught was not so not so
Right.
diverse, right? And so all that said, let's just jump into this, maybe start with like what the Gospel of Thomas is for people who maybe aren't too familiar with it, because maybe a lot of people have heard stuff about it, because like I did in seminary, but it was just like it's evil and wrong and don't read it. So maybe we could talk about what it is, where it came from, all that stuff, and then we'll talk about your book and some of the unique perspective that you bring into it. So wade us into the waters, teach us, take us to school.
Okay, well, I'll try. Well, the Gospel of Thomas, it's really funny because it's often called a Gnostic gospel, and the thing about so it's not a Gnostic text, first of all. And what I mean by that is Gnosticism is a very, if you've ever read in any of Gnostic stuff or even heard about Gnosticism, it's pretty wonky. There's a lot of wackadoodle ideas in what we call Sethian Gnosticism. And Thomas doesn't include any teachings along those lines. Like, it doesn't say that there's two different gods, and one created, one is one, the demiurge, that created us, or the planet Earth isn't the one that created, isn't God, Jesus's father. And there's all these different kind of hierarchies of
Some of
angels
those
and
stories are like a science fiction move, right? It's like super weird. There's so many different things, but
it's pretty weird.
yeah, I
So
can't follow them. When I read them, I'm like, I don't know what's going
no,
on.
to me, it's fan fiction. It's nonsense. I just like, yeah, whatever. So it's not Gnostic at all. So just when people call it Gnostic, take that away. It's not a Gnostic text. It's not even technically a gospel because, it doesn't include any, like there's no birth narrative. There's nothing about the life of Jesus. There's nothing about the crucifixion, the resurrection. There's no conversations about, the second coming, what's going to happen in the apocalypse or anything like that. Although the disciples ask him those kinds of questions, but it's not teaching you anything along those lines. And it's just a collection of the sayings of Jesus, which I think to me is really, it's really fascinating. And half of the sayings in Thomas appear in the synoptic text, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And the other half are unique. So that's what Thomas is really. It kind of proves a theory that until it was discovered in 1945, biblical scholars debated or theorized that there must have been something called a Q document, which was a collection of the sayings of Jesus that both Matthew and Luke must have used when they wrote their gospels, because when they quote Jesus, they quote him verbatim. And so the idea was they were both using, another document that we don't have a copy of, the theoretically a Q document. But there was no evidence that any such thing ever existed until we uncovered the text of Mark and Matthew and realized that Thomas, not only do we have a full text of the Gospel of Thomas, what we realized was that Thomas in itself was simply a collection of the sayings of Jesus. It was a type of a Q document. So it proves that those things did exist.
Are there people who think that Thomas is the Q document? Because I've heard some people say that before.
Yeah, some people do. I think it's a minority of people who do. And honestly, I have not dived that deep into it. It may or may not be. The one thing that blew my mind when I was researching my book was I came across a quote by John Dominic Crossan, and he was talking about how if you lay Matthew and Luke side by side with Thomas, scholars have sort of created a hypothetical Q document. Like, so the Q document must have included these types of sayings. There are more Q document sayings in Thomas than in the other gospels. So
Interesting.
that does then suggest that it could possibly be the actual Q document itself, because it is not only an example of a Q type document, it contains almost all, or more Q document, quotations than the others combined. So that's pretty interesting. It could be. It could be. I won't die on that hill. But it could be. I mean, there's, and I talk about this real quick in my book, because right before I published the book, there was a discovery and translation of a couple of fragments that had been, found in a garbage dump somewhere. And it literally right before I published the book, this was, this came out. So I had to like pop that in the book right at the last minute. And one of the fragments contained a quotation. Well, there were three sayings from Jesus. So we've kind of found another fragment of another Q type document. It was a collection of the
Interesting.
sayings of Jesus, but one of the sayings was from Matthew, one was from Luke, and one was from Thomas. So that also proved that people had a habit of carrying around, collections of the sayings of Jesus, maybe for their own personal use or just, carrying it around. And but they valued Thomas equally with quotes from Matthew and Luke, which I think is very, very interesting. So yeah, very. And what was really especially exciting about that fragment was they said it's the oldest copy of a fragment of the Gospel of Matthew that we have that exists. Yeah, and it's right next to a quote from Thomas. So,
That's so interesting. First of all, I never heard about the Q document, even in seminary. They didn't talk
Oh,
about that in my
really?
evangelical
I guess
world.
they didn't embrace that idea.
Yeah, we're not gonna go there. So I didn't really learn about that until I came across, I started the podcast, started talking to, Crossan and Ehrman, all these people. I'm
Yeah.
like, oh, this is very interesting. But if that's the case, I feel like that bring so much more life to our gospels, because it's like, rather than like there were all these maybe written stories that were going around, there were these sayings,
Yeah.
and then the gospel writers perhaps took those sayings and formulated some stories around them, which could
Yes.
tell us why the stories are often so different. Because as much as we'd like to say, and we said this in school all the time, there's very minor contradictions to the stories, but some of the stories vary in some very dramatic ways. And I
Yes.
think it was Ehrman who said that, Matthew didn't write the exact same story as Mark, because Matthew wasn't trying to write the same story
Thank
as
you.
Mark. He was writing to a particular audience of people. And so
Right.
maybe they took these sayings, like, oh, yeah, let's take this saying and formulate
Yeah.
the story around it like this. But I feel like for me, that brings so much more humanity to the text, which
Right.
also I think makes it even more divine in a way, because it's like, God is inspiring the story through the writers. And I just feel like it just makes it so, puts skin on the text, so to speak.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, and I talk about that in the book as well. That and thank you. I wasn't actually aware that Ehrman or kind of argued that direction, because that was the impression I was getting as I was going through the sayings in Thomas. Because there's a fascinating sort of thing that happens when you're reading the sayings of Jesus and Thomas and you don't have any story, right? It's not Jesus traveled from Jerusalem to Galilee, and on the way he encountered blah blah blah, and then he
The
said, and
Jesus
then
cam, right?
yeah, and then there's a quote, right? So there's no story around it to sort of force you to read it in a certain way. And when you kind of pull that away and you just have the quote, it really brings life to the quote. It's like now suddenly like, oh, this could mean many things. Because I got the impression, just like you're saying, Bart was mentioning, I got the feeling like it feels like that. It feels like Mark and Matthew and Luke wanted to tell a story, started telling their story, and when they came to the spot where Jesus had to say something, they kind of looked over, scanned down these quotes and said, okay, that'll be good. And they just put that quote in
We
there.
use that,
Yeah.
right?
And I mean, and that it, there's evidence that like that's kind of what happened, because even though they are quoting Jesus saying the same things, they quite often are having him saying it to different people at different times in different contexts.
That's right.
And that will change the way you understand it. So
That's right.
I kind of appreciate in Thomas that we don't have any of that. It's just the saying. And then now you get to really, read that saying at face value and ponder, like, okay, what's some deeper meaning here that's going on?
So the book, some people say that the book is, there's like a group that dates it earlier, and there's a group that
Yep.
dates it later. And when I
Yep.
heard about it in school, it was always the later day.
Yes.
Like, this was written way later on, and it's somebody's heresy, whatever. But I think there's a large amount of scholars, probably the majority, I think, who date it
Yeah.
earlier. Some would even say that it maybe precedes the traditional gospels, or at least written
Yeah.
around the same time as them. So where do you
Yes.
fall? Like, and where do you fall, and why, if it is earlier, why does that matter? Why is that so significant?
Right. Well, you're right. So I think if you date it, when you hear people who are critical of Thomas, that those are the sort of the dismissive things. It was written much, much later. It was written after the other gospels that we have in our texts in the Bible. Therefore, let's disqualify it because someone just made this crazy stuff up at the end, right? And so, but that isn't the case. Like, again, the more I looked into Thomas, the more I realized I feel like there's way more evidence, including this fragment I just talked about. Like,
Right.
well,
That's huge.
here's a quote from Thomas alongside, Matthew and Luke, and it's the oldest copy of anything from Matthew we currently have. Like, that's lending some evidence, but there's way more evidence. And so you're right. There, scholars don't agree on anything, right? So everyone
It's hard to
disagrees.
find, yeah.
Everyone has a different opinion. So it kind of does seem though that like there are groups of scholars, and I think that is a growing number of scholars, who are beginning to look at Thomas and say it's very likely that Thomas falls. And again, this is where the division is. I would say probably a minority of them, I think, my impression is that a minority of them would say it's before Mark, meaning it predates the synoptic texts. I think a more conservative number of them would say, and this is kind of where I think I fall in, because until there's evidence, hard evidence on the other side of it, it's the safer bet to say that Thomas is dated at least somewhere between Mark and John. And the evidence for that is really strong. One of those, one, some of that is that it seems that whoever wrote the Gospel of John is reacting to things in Thomas. And that's not accidental. There's specific things that it's reacting to. So whoever wrote John had to know Thomas existed, right? But there is evidence, and I found this really compelling. It's just difficult to know how to nuance it. And I mentioned this in the book. So there's one of the sayings of Thomas that is it, that the Apostle Paul quotes the saying. And when he quotes it, I think it's in 1 Corinthians, he says, as it is written, and then he quotes it. So it's like he's saying, this is scripture, right? That's how you talk when you're getting ready to quote scripture, as it is written. And then he quotes this, and it mirrors exactly, I think, saying 22 from the Gospel of Thomas. And so now we know Paul's writings do predate the Gospels, right? What we don't know is that is he, when he says, as it is written, is he quoting a document called Thomas that's a full collection of all of those sayings, and he's aware of it? That's possible. But it's also possible that people just had the sayings of Jesus. Again, there were lots of Q-type documents, or
In their
maybe
pocket,
verbally, people were just, had memorized the sayings of Jesus, and these were common things that they repeated to one another when they got together. And it was a common saying of Jesus that everyone knew. And so when he says, as it is written, he's just repeating that saying, and then maybe someone, whoever wrote Thomas, put it down after the fact. We can't know that. But it's very compelling. I mean, it's really compelling to me to see that at least Paul is aware of these quotations, and it lends credence to the fact that at least Paul the Apostle thought that Jesus had said this, like this was a legitimate saying of Jesus.
Now, is this gospel was this gospel suppressed in your estimation?
Yes.
Because there's again, I mean, we talked about this before,
Yeah.
but this came up on your Facebook page and it comes up in a lot of different places because I've seen people sharing your content on their
Yes.
pages and that starts a dialogue. And a lot of the dialogue is around that topic of whether or not this was suppressed, by the
Yeah.
church father. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I know I have heard those people say those things. I actually had a comment on one of my posts, a couple of weeks ago about that exact thing. Like, oh, it wasn't suppressed. It was dismissed and ignored because it was worthless, right? Kind of a thing. It wasn't worth being, suppressed. And I think that is clearly not the case. And I want to just shout out to Elaine Pagels, who you had on your show before, and she wrote an amazing book called Beyond Belief, which was so helpful to me.
There it
Yeah,
is.
fantastic book. And it oh just opened my eyes to, the sort of the plurality of Christianities, plural, in the early church. And because again, I was told something very different, that like there was just one Christianity. Maybe there was this one little fringe group, the little Gnostics were over there on the side, but they were inconsequential and they went away. But Elaine Pagels points out that there were the she calls the proto-Orthodox, people like Irenaeus and Tertullian and all these guys. And then but then there were others where there were the pure Gnostics, like Sethian Gnostics, but there are also the Valentinians and many, many others, probably more than we even know, because they didn't last, right? They got stamped out. And in her book, she talks about how, and she provides quotations of Irenaeus and others, point blank. I think the other one is Clement of Alexandria is another one that kind of speaks out specifically targeting, saying, do not read the Gospel of Thomas or this so-called Gospel of Thomas. And so yes, Thomas was suppressed. And we see a suppression of Thomas What's funny, though, is she also, Elaine Pagels mentions, even though Irenaeus was trying desperately to stamp out Thomas, and I think it was mostly because I think it was less about the content of Thomas, because again, half the say they're just sayings of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Half the sayings are already in the Gospels that you have. Mm-hmm. So what are you so upset about? I personally think it's less the fact that Thomas existed, and I think it was more that there was a faction of Christians that loved and preferred Thomas. Mm-hmm. And I think Irenaeus and others felt like if they could basically discredit Thomas, they could discredit this group. And that would be the Valentinians, right? Mm-hmm. Who I find fascinating. The more I read about Valentinus, I'm very fascinated by that guy. I mean, yeah. If I lived back then, I would probably have been a Valentinian. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That
yeah.
guy was on something. He was the kind of, and according to his detractors, he was the disciple of a guy named, I think it was Theodos, who was a disciple of Paul the Apostle. So it seems like these teachings that they were following, which are mirrored the sayings from Thomas, which we're going to get into in a little bit. Mm-hmm. They're all about sort of a unity and connection with the divine and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they were all about that. So I think it was largely suppressed because Irenaeus and others felt that politically, this group was a threat to them. And we can trace it, and Elaine Pagels does a wonderful job of sort of tracing this conflict all the way up to the Athanasius. Mm-hmm. Because Athanasius now, once the church has sort of the power of Rome on their side after Constantine, Athanasius feels he has the authority to write letters to all these, you know, churches and monasteries and tell them, here's a list of books you are no longer allowed to quote from or read from during, you know, the worship services. Mm-hmm. And Thomas is one of them, which means, mm-hmm. by the way, they were then doing that. Yeah. For that, like, you know, 400 years they're doing this. They're reading Thomas. They're reading Thomas alongside other texts.
Yeah.
And Athanasius, he writes what's called the Easter letter and says, we're not doing this anymore. And it's not coincidental that that's about the time that the Nag Hammadi texts were buried in the sand, you know, in Egypt.
Yeah.
So it seems that someone, God bless them, at some monastery in Egypt, instead of getting that letter and burning and destroying this list of texts, takes them all, puts them in a jar, seals it, and buries it in the ground where it sat from, like, what, 340 AD until 1945.
So interesting. Like, I, you know, you said before, but that's not what we've been, not what you were told, not what I was told, that it was, you know, there's just one stream of Christianity. There might have been this other stream, but they obviously got it wrong. And, you know, they got cut off by the church fathers. But reading Pagel's work, reading Ehrman's work, you'd come to really realize, you know, digging into the history, that the Orthodox, like the proto-Orthodox that Elaine refers to, they were the pre-Orthodox people. They were just one of those streams of Christianity. Like, they were just one of the groups that was out there, but they happened to be the ones that won because of that marriage with the Roman Empire and things like that. So a lot of power came to them.
Yes.
And they were able to be the ones who got to write history, so to speak.
Yes.
But I think if you can peel all that away and let yourself realize that there were so many different groups for really hundreds of years, you know, thinking about all these different things, it brings a whole different light to this topic of Christianity. It makes me so excited that I can really identify myself as a Christian, because for a long time I was like, I don't think I'm going to be a Christian anymore, because I don't think I believe this kind of narrow stream, but realizing it's so much more diverse is freeing.
No, you're right. And see, that's what I really appreciated about Elaine's book, was that it did make you realize, like, and I think she even says this, like, there were all these different factions, as you're mentioning, and this is the thing. They all called themselves Christians. If you asked them, who are you and what do you believe? They'd say, I follow Jesus.
Right.
I believe in Jesus.
Yep.
And they would probably have either, you know, maybe they used the Gospels, maybe they had Thomas or other collections, maybe some kind of a Q document. But in their minds, we are following Jesus. We love Jesus. We're all about Jesus.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like the Christians versus the heretics, right? That's kind of the version of the story we've been told.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right. And that was also helpful for me, because when I was reading Elaine and she was explaining that who Valentinus was, I honestly never heard of him until I read her book. Who is this guy? Right. I'm suddenly not digging. I'm going down the wormhole.
Valentine's Day, right?
Yeah. Who is Valentinus?
Right.
He's a different guy. He's not Saint Valentine, different guy.
Yep.
And I realized, like, so we also think that there was another text called the Gospel of Truth that was discovered at Nag Hammadi, which again, we just heard rumors of it when no one had any, you know, copies of it until we got a copy at Nag Hammadi. And then the the theory is that many people think Valentinus actually wrote the Gospel of Truth, which is interesting. We're gonna have a whole text, and but it was just a really fascinating way that they looked at the way they thought about God, right? They really believed that Christ was in everyone. In their worship services, like Irenaeus hated this, and he kind of goes off on them, like he's complaining, like when these Valentinians get together, men and women and children are allowed to read the scriptures. They're allowed to read the text. They're allowed to lead the prayers. And I'm like, yes, how beautiful, right? It's not just the man and the bishop and everybody else sit down and shut up. It was very participatory, and they allowed women and children equally to participate in the worship gatherings. And I'm like, dude, I would have been right there. I would
That's
have been
right.
right there with those guys. And what's shocking about that too, I guess, is to realize, like, before realizing that, I would have thought if I had been a Christian back then, I would have been with Irenaeus, right? Because he was the real deal. I would have been with Tertullian, at least, like, although he's horrible. You know what I mean? I just thought theologically I would align myself more with those guys, and then realize, no, really, actually, I think I would have disagreed with a lot of what those guys were about.
So good. All right, your book. What, let's talk about this. What is in the intro, you talk about how you were inspired a lot by William Duffy. What was the name of his book? The Hidden Gospel of Thomas, I
The Hidden
believe.
Gospel of Thomas.
And that book, I mean, it's so fascinating, but I can definitely see by reading your book that there's a definitely a lot of influence there. So talk to us about like what unique perspective are you and even like Duffy bringing to this gospel? Because even though it's new, even though it was recently discovered, there is a fair amount of thoughts floating around out there about the book. So what kind of perspective are you bringing into it? What does this talk about quantum sayings? What does quantum have to do with it? Take us into that.
Well, I mean, but to your point though, I think it's interesting though that, like, Thomas, as compared to the other gospels that we have, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we have like 2,000 years of commentary and thought, right, about that. And Thomas, we have commentary from pretty much my lifetime, right? Like,
That's
it
right.
wasn't translated into English until like 1959. I think it was English. An English text was made available publicly for like in maybe in the 70s or something like that. So it's a very short window of time that people are really, scholars are really beginning to read it and study it and look into it and see, well, what is this all about? So that's exciting to be like, wow, we're kind of at the beginning. You know what I mean? Like, we're the Irenaeuses of the day or something, you know, for this text. And yeah, I will say Duffy's book changed my mind. When the first time I read Thomas a few years before that, I was curious about it. Someone had mentioned it, probably Jamal, somebody like that, said, "Oh, you got to read Thomas." And I found it online. You can read it for free. It's just, again, 114 sayings of Jesus. I found someone online. I read through it, and I just thought, this is stupid. It's the dumbest thing I've ever read. It makes no sense. Why would anybody take this seriously? Or I just said, forget it. And then maybe like 3 or 4 years later, someone mailed me. I honestly don't know who did it. Someone mailed me a copy of Duffy's book, The Hidden Gospel of Thomas, and said, you told me, Keith, you got to read this. I'm like, oh, okay. And I was going to take a trip, so I was flying somewhere, and so I took it, put it on my bag, and I'm on the plane, and I read through the introduction to Duffy's book. And in the introduction, Duffy, God bless him, man, thank you, William Duffy. And I, by the way, I've talked to him, I called him, and we had a Zoom call together where I just said thank you so much, because it changed everything for me. I'm on the plane, I'm reading his introduction, and he says, like, many people don't understand Thomas. I'm like, yep, that's me. Makes no sense to
Right,
me.
bingo.
Not guilty as charged. And he goes, well, it's because you're not reading it through the proper lens, right? If you have the proper lens, and then you understand, then it all comes into focus. It makes total sense. And I'm like, well, okay, if you say so. And he kind of lays out kind of like what that code, how to crack the code. And at first he just kind of says, you have to read it all through the lens, I think he says, of like oneness and connection or something like that. I'm like, okay, that's a good theory, and then he gave some examples, and like, when I read it through that lens, I'm like, okay, yeah, okay, makes a little more sense now, okay. But then I'm still thinking, yeah, but that's so arbitrary, like, it's easy to just, like, I came up with something that makes it make sense, but so what? I mean, that doesn't mean that it is the way to read it. And then I turned the page, and he just like nailed it and dropped the bomb, and I'm like, he's right. Oh my gosh. Like, because the sort of the key, I guess I'll give this part away. The key he said the key was, I think it's saying seven, which early on in the Gospel of Thomas, there's a saying, which again, without a filter, and a, you know, you're, it makes no sense, right? It's like, blessed is the lion that becomes a man, and cursed is the man who becomes a lion, or something like that. It's like, what the hell? That makes no sense. But then he says, you know, well, you know, again, it's metaphorical, right? So the lion is sort of your ego self, and the man is the true self, your who you really are. And I'm like, okay, well, okay, that makes sense. Okay, and now it makes sense. But again, that's arbitrary. And he says, well, Plato in his Republic uses the exact same, which again predates the Gospels. Plato uses that exact, almost the exact same metaphor to talk about the ego and the true self. He uses the lion and the chimera and the man as the true self. I'm like, well, that's interesting, but again, so what? And then he says, here's where he dropped the bomb. He goes, by the way, at the Nag Hammadi, you know, discovery, when we opened the jar and we, you know, went through all the codexes, in the same codex with Thomas and some other books that were kind of bound together, was a like a single page from Plato's Republic. Guess which page? The single page where he explains the idea of the lion and the man.
It's crazy. It gives me chills.
Yes, it's like somebody wanted you to know, here's how to decode it, guys. Here's how to understand Thomas. Boom. So that was it for me. I'm like, this is legit.
Now you're
I
hooked.
Believe that this is real. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so then I just started diving into Thomas. And then the more I read, the more I wanted to read, the more I kept reading. And so, yeah, that was kind of my beginning of like falling in love with Thomas and wanting to know as much as I could about it.
Yeah. So define quantum for us, for maybe people who are new to that word, because it seems to be a word that's floating around a little bit more these days in the world of spirituality. But what does that word mean? What does that have to do with Thomas?
Yeah. Well, a lot more than I more than
the,
I
tried
initially
to cover your book. So
but more than I initially thought.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So, you know, sort of concurrently, as I was kind of diving into Thomas, I was also around that time, I'd finished writing my 7-part Jesus Son series. I was writing Solo Mysterium about embracing the, you know, the beautiful uncertainty of everything. And then reading, you know, writing that book was, you know, I was going down the road, excuse me, of looking into like quantum science and things like that, and doing a lot of reading around those things. So reading quantum scientists, reading, you know, actual quantum physicists, and reading some of like more like the mystical quantum kind of side of things as well. And so I guess to explain quantum through quantum physics without getting into the weeds too much, what quantum scientists are realizing is that the world as we perceive it is an illusion, right? That at the quantum level, even though we perceive everything through our senses as separate, things are separate, right? You're you, I'm me. This is my microphone. This is my coffee cup. These are separate in things, objects and people, and we're all separate. There's we experience a world of separation, distinct objects and distinct people. Quantum physics, one of the things we learn from quantum physics is that that's not reality as it really is. What quantum physics is showing us is that there's only one thing, and that's the quantum field. In other words, every single thing that you see and experience, including yourself, we are all expressions. Everything is an expression of the quantum field. There's just a quantum field, and it's an unbroken expression, right? And when you realize that, it's like, okay, then everything is connected. And then the other thing about the quantum field is that for the longest time, scientists, and there's been sort of like, you know, there's always been sort of a battle between scientists and theologians or philosophers, right? Scientists largely are materialists, and they would say the only thing that's real is matter, right? Things we can measure and taste and touch and, you know, things like that, molecules, particles, atoms. This is real. And other things, right, are not real, right? So like the soul, spiritual realms, like that's mystical, crazy, and it's not real because science can't prove it's real and we can't measure it. But the philosophers and the theologians have countered that argument to say, well, okay, scientists, and if that's the case, then you need to explain how consciousness arises out of matter. And so that's been kind of the back and forth debate for, you know, eons. But through quantum physics, and there are quotes and from quantum scientists who are realizing, and they actually are saying exactly this. I think Sir James Jean is the one I quote all the time. He was a very famous quantum physicist, and he wrote a book. And in his book, he says, we can no longer talk about the universe as a great machine, meaning something material. We must now speak of the universe as a great thought or a consciousness. And it's the realization. So in other words, the question, how does consciousness arise from matter, is the wrong question. We should flip it over. The real question is, how does matter arise from consciousness? Consciousness and consciousness is sort of a metaphor for, or another way of saying, the quantum field, that the quantum field itself is consciousness. So there is one great consciousness, right? That everything is made of and in and through. And so if you have any sort of Christian background, you should begin to notice that this starts to sound a lot like...
Alarm should be going off. Ding, ding, ding.
In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God and was God, and the Logos became flesh and dwelt among us. Or, you know, the quantum field is all and is in all. And we are filled with the consciousness, you know, that fills everything in every way. So Paul uses the word Christ. Quantum physicists use the word quantum field. John uses the word Logos. You know, someone else might use the word consciousness, but they're interchangeable, these concepts. So, and again, this is exactly, this is why I call my book The Quantum Sayings of Jesus. When you're reading Thomas and you realize, again, the filter you have to use to understand what Jesus is saying in Thomas is this idea that separation is an illusion, that you and I are connected to the divine, and therefore we are connected to one another. And any divisions of male and female, you know, rich or poor, young or old, again, Paul says this in Galatians. But this is exactly what Jesus is elaborating on in Thomas. All those things are illusions. Jesus says you will enter the kingdom when you can make, you know, the inside like the outside, and the lower as the upper, and the upper as the lower, and the male as the female, so that the male is no longer male, and the female is no longer female, but they are one. Like, again, these are quantum sayings. Jesus is saying what quantum physics is saying now, and what mystics have been saying for hundreds of years, thousands of years, whether that's Rumi or Black Elk or St. Teresa of Avila, or, you know, just across the board, this very simple but very profound and powerful idea of the illusion of separation, this idea of divine, that we have a shared divinity and a shared humanity. And that's a really powerful, powerful message.
What's interesting to me is that they're, you know, all these scientists, modern day scientists, are coming to these realizations, like they're studying quantum physics and they're doing all this like stuff that they wouldn't have dreamed of way back then. But they're coming to the same conclusions. About, and as things that were written literally thousands of years ago. And that alone shows you a connection, right? Talk about everything being connected. If these people who are predating all this technology that we have are writing these ideas that we're using our amazing technology to come to, there's a connection there between us and them. Right there is the whole idea. That's the whole idea of the book.
It is fascinating. Yeah, it is so fascinating. It's like these people, again, like thousands of years ago, are able, like, whatever, through meditation, through you know, just a mystical experience, a spiritual experience, a profound sort of aha moment, are able to realize this kind of truth that, oh my gosh, I'm one with everything. And I know I think we've talked about this before. People also have arrived at this realization, sometimes through a near-death experience, right? People will have a near-death experience. They'll enter, go through the light, feel this incredible connection with the light, have this incredible feeling of love and in connection with everyone else, and come back from that experience saying, oh my gosh, I get it now. I see it now. People have had the same realizations when they take mushrooms, right? Or ayahuasca or DMT. Or they come back from that experience saying, oh my gosh, I experience being one with the universe and with everyone else. And so however you get to it, whether it's through quantum science, whether it's through a spiritual experience, whether it's through a near-death experience, whether it's some, you know, chemical thing in your brain. But it is a shared human experience and realization, and having it validated by quantum science is really significant. It's really powerful. And hopefully it's something that makes us take it seriously.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's been interesting to me, and I don't, this is probably true for you too. You can speak for yourself, but coming to these realizations, like reading the Gospel of Thomas, particularly through this kind of lens, thinking about, we've had conversations on the podcast before about oneness and things like that. But what's interesting to me is that I didn't see that stuff in the Bible before. Like
right.
I didn't see it in the Gospels. I didn't see it in Paul's writing. I would have said, that's New Age. That's crazy talk, you know, whatever. Right. But now that I've seen this stuff, I can't unsee it
right
in the Bible. Because like you just talked about Paul, you talked about things Jesus has said. Like for me, the big one is like Jesus saying, I and the Father are one. You and I are one, right? Like we're literally all connected. Like there's this, there is this Holy Trinity there, so to speak, of this connection between us and the universe and God and everything else. Like you can't, once you see it, you can't, it's everywhere.
That's right. No, you're exactly. It's
and
exactly
I read everything through that filter now when it comes to the Bible, like, and I see it all over the place.
Yeah. No, and that's another realization I had as I was going through Thomas was, again, if you think it's hard, sometimes you need to stop and remind yourself sometimes that chronological, our Bibles are not chronological, right? The New Testament is not arranged chronologically. So because the Gospels come first, people assume, and because it's about Jesus and Jesus came first, they assume that those Gospels were written first. And then later, because Paul came later, that Paul wrote his letters after the Gospels. But that's not, it's the other way around. Before there were any, before Mark, before any of those, right, which is the oldest Gospel, before the Gospel of Mark was written or any of the other Gospels, there were just the writings of Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And they think Paul, again, scholars don't agree. Some have said his first letter was Galatians. I think some they say it's, I think it's First Thessalonians or something. Anyway, but one of his first letters, put it this way, was Galatians. And if you think about it this way, right? So try to put yourself, I try to do this, put myself in this mindset. You're a follower of Jesus in the first century, right? People are telling you this Jesus guy existed. Maybe you saw him speak once or twice, but maybe not, you know, maybe someone you know did. And anyway, you hear about Jesus, you're like, wow, I'm really fascinated by this Jesus guy. I'm going to follow Jesus, right? Okay, so you're gathering with some people in a home and you're getting together. And then, oh, there's a letter from this apostle, Paul. It just showed up and you happen to live, let's say, in Galatia. And someone opens this letter and all you know about is Jesus. Maybe you have some of the sayings of Jesus, some of the teachings of Jesus, maybe some of the parables, right? Mm-hmm. But you're into this Jesus guy. And now you get this letter from Paul. And for the first time ever, someone says to you that to be in Christ, there is no, that erases all the us and them distinctions. Because Paul says in Galatians that in Christ, there is no Jew or Gentile, slave or free, male or female, young or old. He goes something. Because why? We are all one in Christ. What is that? No one's ever said, no one's ever suggested this idea before.
Yeah.
That we have a shared oneness and that our divisions and separations evaporate in the reality of Christ. That is powerful. And so it's not, again, did Paul invent that? Or is that something, again, that he's just telling them what they already believed and knew anyway? Because these sayings of Jesus were floating around, right? And there were different streams of Christianity. And there were kinds of Christians who were aware of some of the sayings from Thomas.
Yeah.
And we're repeating those and saying, yes, you know, Jesus tells us that we're all one and we're all connected.
Yeah.
But at any rate, there's evidence then that early on, as early as you can get, right, in church history, this idea of our oneness and the dissolving of separations is the reality that happens in Christ. It's right there in the very beginning.
Yeah. So good. What's your favorite saying? 114.
Oh man.
I'm sure you have a whole bunch that you,
I do.
You probably come to mind, but if you had to like nail one down, that's like, man, this one really made me think. What one would
be? They all made me think. let me see. Well, I think one of the ones that, you put me on the spot here, man. I think, let me see. I'm going to look it up. I think.
Got all those sticky notes. I love it.
Yeah, I know. So I think, I will say, I'll read you the one that is my favorite, but I will say, I had so much fun going through, because before I even knew this was going to be a book, I just started doing like every Friday, I would publish, an article on my blog or my Patreon, where I would just quote one of the sayings of Jesus and kind of give my commentary on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say, man, almost on a weekly basis, I would come to one of the sayings and sometimes initially be like, I don't really know what this is, you know, but I would spend some time with it. And what I loved was digging something out of it that was like, oh my gosh, you know, it just like the light would come on and be like, ah, that I get it. Oh, this is so cool. And especially what I especially loved when that would happen, because what I tried to do is I would just every day when I would write these, I would just look at the saying. I wouldn't have any commentaries open. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be looking at what anybody else says about it. I want to just say, this is what I think it says. Right.
Yeah.
And there were some beautiful times when I would write out everything I think I got out of it. And then I would go and look at the commentaries. And what I loved was I loved both when I would look at a commentary and the commentary agreed with me and was like, mm-hmm. Oh, you got it. Yeah. You saw it. Okay, good. What I loved even more was when I read the commentaries and nobody got what I saw. And I was like, yes. Okay. I feel like I got something out of this. No one else got it. So that was a lot of fun.
I love it.
So there's so many, I mean, it's hard to pick one there because sure. Several of them are really, just really profound and very powerful. The one that pops in my mind, I might change my mind later, but but I mentioned saying 22, and this is a very key saying. It actually is one that I think unlocks some of the more difficult sayings, because there's some sayings like Duffy and I disagreed when we talked, because I'd read through his book and he also goes through the sayings and kind of gives his impressions of them. And there were several sayings where like he and I didn't agree on that. Like I was like, no, I think it's this. And he was like, no, I think it's that. You know, again, friendly. It wasn't an argument.
Back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was just like, you know, he saw it one way. I had a different perspective. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this was one that I really like. And I think it unlocks some of the more difficult sayings that also appear later in Thomas. So this one is different. Most of the times the sayings begin with the disciples asking Jesus something. Mm-hmm. But this one, he says, Jesus is the one sort of like, he's the one kicking it off. He says, mm-hmm. Jesus saw some infants who were being suckled. He said to his disciples, these infants being suckled are like those who enter the kingdom. They said to him, shall we then become infants to enter the kingdom? And Jesus said to them, when you make the two one, and when you make the inside as the outside, and the outside as the inside, and the upper as the lower, when you make the male and the female into a single one, so that the male is not male and the female is not female, and when you make eyes in place of an eye, and a hand in place of a hand, and a foot in place of a foot, an image in place of an image, then you shall enter the kingdom. And it's so profound. Like it starts off, you think you know where it's going, because oh, we've heard Jesus say this is the kingdom of God, or like little children, blah blah blah. Yeah, and like yes, that's he does kind of say those kind of things in there as well. But when he flips it around and just says, guys, when I tell you the kingdom is like these infants, right? I'm not saying crawl around on all fours and in a diaper, right? Okay. I'm trying to say to you that there is a simplicity that infants have before this veil of separation is pulled over their eyes, right? Yeah. They're aware of things. Because there's another saying early on too, which I love, where he says that a man old in years will not hesitate to ask an infant 7 days old about the universe and will receive wisdom, right? Yeah. So again, that's that idea that these infants aren't yet sort of conditioned and programmed the way we are to live in this world of separation.
Yeah.
So he's reminding of that idea when he says that. But that idea again of just like saying, guys, there is no separation. You won't see the kingdom until you see that it is all about oneness and connection. So I love that. I love that. That also is kind of a key saying, because I think if you don't have a copy of Plato's Republic to understand saying seven,
no,
it's pretty clear in saying 22. Like, guys, this is reality. This is the way it is. And you have to be able to see things through the lens of oneness and connection, or you're not going to see it.
Yeah. I had Perdita Finn on the show a few months ago, and she's somebody who does a lot of like ancestor work and stuff like that. But she made a comment. It was a very different conversation than this, but the comment that she made really kind of hits home some of the things you just mentioned. And she said that when it comes to our society, we tend to dismiss the children and we tend to dismiss the elderly because they get in the way of getting our missions completed. But she said, those are the people who are the closest to the veil. The children have just maybe, if there is reincarnation, if that's like a thing, she was talking about that. She said, whatever the case, whatever you believe, because children are the closest to the veil, the elderly are the closest to the veil. But there's a sense of oneness there, she said, and a sense of connection. Or if we could just grasp that, we could learn to learn from the children, as opposed to just telling them what to do and telling them what they should be and things like that. And also learn from the elderly and where they've been and the different things that they've experienced and even where in their mind they might think that they're going. If we could just learn, if we could just have that connection, that oneness, it could potentially change everything. And I feel like that's something that just came to light in that saying that you just talked about.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think that is right. Like Jesus is telling us that where wisdom can be found.
That's right.
And yeah, it's very, very true. And it's so beautiful. Yeah. I think also, as you were talking, I was reminded, I totally agree, like children and older elderly people have a simplicity and a wisdom that's so powerful. But I also was thinking, it took me back to a moment. I remember this was during a time in my life when I was out of work. I think I'd been out of work for like a year and a half. I was struggling financially. I was so stressed out. I was like, you know, yelling at God, you know, help me take care of my family and get a job. And I was so, so frustrated. It was a really painful sort of time in my life, a lot of suffering that I was going through during the time. And I was sitting at a stoplight, kind of just like all inside and kind of complaining and yelling at God and, you know, so, so stressed out. And sitting at the stoplight, this person walked in front of me. And she had Down syndrome, but she was so full of joy, right? Just crossing the crosswalk in front of me. And I just looked at her and there was so much joy on her face. And she was just looking at the what a beautiful day and the birds and the trees and the sunshine. And as she crossed in front of me, it was like everything melted for me. It was just like, and I was like, you know how ironic that we think we pity those people, right? Oh, those poor people that have Down syndrome, right? But I thought, no, man, I envy her.
Yeah.
I was like, man, she's got some wisdom that I need desperately, right? She has
That's
a
right.
peace and a wisdom and a joy that is so simple and so beautiful. So yeah, I thought that too. Like, as you were talking, it just took me back to that place. Like, I think, yeah, we get so much in our head. And I think that's why, you know, so many, like the mystics have come to these kind of profound awarenesses of oneness and connection by not doing anything, right? You know, you just be, right? You kind of stop doing and just kind of be. And then all of a sudden, all of this wisdom kind of flood, the realization floods into your consciousness. You're just like, I'm okay. The universe is okay. Like,
That's
I'm all right. You know,
That's
I'm
right.
connected to this great source of love. And it's within me. It's not, I don't have to go get it and chase it. It's all right here.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of wisdom in that.
So good. Keith, we're just about out of time, but this has been a blast. Everybody's got to go get this book. Do yourself a favor, end the podcast, go to Amazon, buy the book because it's so good. But real quick, where can people find you online? And then also, is there any place online where people can get more of this material once they get the book, anywhere they can go to interact with things?
Well, thank you for reminding me because I just realizing all the other podcast interviews I've done, I've forgotten to mention this. So thank
you. There
you
go. Got to come here to the What If Project to get the juice, the real,
this
good,
is
the
the
real good
juice.
stuff.
The juice. You can follow me online. KeithCharles.com is my blog on Pathios. I do 4 podcasts, Heretic Happy Hour, Second Cup with Keith, Apostates Anonymous.
Writing
Everyone's
books,
tonight.
Doing 4 podcasts, Keith. How do you sleep?
not as much as I should.
Right.
I do every Wednesday night on Sirius XM Radio. I do the God Squad, which on Fool Sang. And what else? So yeah, you know, my books are on Amazon. Go check those out. And yes, as you said, if you're curious about Thomas, and especially if you read the book, I would recommend, I have a course, so an online course called Inside Outside. And that's available at choiracademy.com. If you just scroll down, there's tons of courses there. But if you scroll down to choiracademy.com, you'll see the course Inside Outside there. And yeah, we just go a lot deeper into Thomas and some of the sayings and some of the background and history of Thomas and what it's all about.
Awesome. Well, I'll put the links in the show notes and we will do this again. We'll have you back, I'm sure, because you've been here many times.
I have another book coming out in August, so.
There you go. You'll be back. We'll have you back in the fall.
Okay.
Later, dude.
All right. Thanks.